Okay. Good evening. Our topic for tonight is the sociology of mid-20th century conservative Judaism. Now, if you notice, in this course this year, we've been doing for the last 10 months on American Jewish history, I have, to a large degree, avoided religion, because we did religion 3-4 years ago with the denominational course, including something of what was covered, it's going to be covered tonight in this session. But I want to focus not on religion per se, and I'm certainly not on theology, but rather on the sociology of conservative Judaism, which was the dominant denomination and stream of Judaism in the 1950s. So we're going to cover 40s, 50s, 60s, mid-century, from the perspective of the lay people, and based upon a study conducted by Marshall Sklar titled Conservative Judaism, an American Religious Movement, which was written in 1954. An updated version was published in 1972. It is without a doubt the most important sociological survey of mid-20th century American religion, American Judaism. Okay, so he begins by saying that at every year at the Rabbinical Assembly Convention, somebody asks a certain question. And that question is, what is conservative Judaism? That no one knows what it is. What is conservative Judaism? And the rabbi's asking this question, not an ignorant layperson, but rather the leaders of the movement want to know, what is it that we're propagating here? Sklar theorizes that changes in Judaism have their origins in the changes in the lives of Jews. It's a sociological approach. That if we can examine what's happening in the secular lives of Jews, then we can figure out why things are happening and changing in their religious life. So he notes that early on in American Jewish history, there was no heterodox movement. Colonial era Sephardim did not create heterodox movements. And the reason he claims that is because they were already adjusted socially prior to their arrival in the United States, that they did not need a religious metamorphosis to go along with, to be simultaneous with a social metamorphosis. In the 1950s, conservative Judaism was the fastest growing denomination and looked poised to become the regnant form of American Judaism. It was all about social mobility and acculturation. And the rate of acculturation depends upon the pace of social mobility. Jews moved up the socioeconomic ladder faster than any other ethnic group in America. No doubt about it. Faster than any other group. It was not an individual phenomenon. It was a group phenomenon. And along with that comes religious changes. When a group recognizes that it can it has a claim to tradition, and the tradition has a claim on it, but that they can't live up to the tradition, then they invent a label which is different than orthodoxy. In the view of the conservative layperson, acculturation is inevitable and okay, but assimilation must be prevented, and therefore a style must be developed that will thwart assimilation. Ethnic solidarity is the key, and the survival of the ethnic group is the most desired end. Also, the survival of the ethnic group will prevent anomie, from you becoming simply an anonymous person, just another guy, another gal, but without any real identity. And Jews are more desirous of retaining their group identity than pretty much any other group. You take the Italians, the Irish, okay, any group in America, any ethnic group, other than the original WASP crowd, they all want to keep that that label about them. There's certain cultural vestiges. But more than any other group, the Jews want to do this. And the conservative movement is a way to experiment, a will to live, a modus vivendi to try to figure out how can we live as Jews in America. Judaism is an ethnic church. And to survive, the group needs to survive. Meaning the religion can't exist in a vacuum. If you don't have Jews, you don't have Judaism. So you have to have people want to maintain their Jewish identity. However, in 1940s and 50s America, the only legitimate basis for the maintaining of an ethnic label is under a religious auspices, meaning it's not kosher in mid-20th century America to try to preserve your Jewish identity just for the sake of being Jewish. But for religion's sake, that's okay. So conservative Judaism will be Jewishness under the auspices of what is ostensibly a religious denomination, but where the primary goal is the preservation of Jewishness.
Okay.
People flock to religious institutions and they build them up, despite not being all that interested in the theological and ritual content of those buildings and those institutions, but because it's the right thing to do. You're expected to be a good Jew, and a good Jew means preserving that that label of American Jew. Conservative Judaism was highly congregational. The individual synagogue does whatever it wants. There's no archdiocese bossing you around like it is in the Catholic Church or in certain Protestant denominations, which means the shul must support itself. It doesn't get money from citywide philanthropy or from some hierarchy. There's no archdiocese giving out shekels here and there. Every synagogue is an entity unto itself and must raise its own money and survive on its own. So now we turn to Orthodoxy in transition. How did it come to be that conservative synagogues were established? What predated them? Where did these people who founded these synagogues go to shul before they established the conservative shul? What is their religious backstory? And the answer is that most of the synagogues in mid-20th century or even 1930s and even to 1920s were founded as conservative synagogues were established by people who were second-generation American Jews of Eastern European background who had moved up the socioeconomic ladder and had moved out of the old neighborhoods. So American Orthodoxy did not adapt quickly enough. It suffered institutional decay in the 19-teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Religion by its nature changes very slowly, and Orthodox Judaism fit that bill. Changed very slowly. They tried to adapt where they could on the margins, but the urban environment was not conducive for making the necessary changes. The decline in localism meant that you didn't have to have a shul just of people from one town in Europe, the Landsmannschaft shul. You could have a cathedral Orthodox shul in areas of first and second settlement. You could have that. And the people who went to these shuls were not observant Orthodox Jews in the sense that they went to an Orthodox shul, but they weren't all that frum. Shabbos, Kashrut was observed in the breach more than in the observance. So these Orthodox synagogues, the big ones, did not have real good staying power on two fronts. One, the piety wasn't there. And secondly, the commitment to living in that neighborhood wasn't there. People were on the move. They're going to go. And as soon as they have the cash to go somewhere better, they're gone. So most conservative Jews grew up in the second area of settlement, Orthodox shuls. In that shul, the rabbi was not the main player. The shamash, the sexton, was the main functionary. The rabbi was a scholar of the old world. But nobody cared to learn from him. He was a long-bearded rabbi who knew some Talmud, but who was learning Talmud? Nobody. He made money from selling chametz and officiating at weddings and funerals. There was some Talmud study for the old people, but younger people didn't come to these learning sessions. There was no youth department. These shuls did not cater to the young. The ladies were in the balcony, and they had the ladies' auxiliary, which is a precursor to the sisterhood. The Talmud Torah for the children was only nominally affiliated with the shul. Leadership of the shul was in the hands of whom? It was in the hands of people of low status aspiration. Low status aspiration. Why do I say that? Because if they had higher status aspiration, they'd leave the neighborhood. They'd take their cash and they'd go to a nicer place to live. So who runs the shul? The people who are committed to staying in the less prestigious neighborhood. All right. So when younger people try to tinker with things, the rabbi is in danger. Why is the rabbi in danger? Because the rabbi speaks Yiddish. His English isn't all that good. He doesn't cater to the young. He won't tinker with the religion. So when the lay people try to take control, the younger lay people, the rabbi could be the first thing gone. But oftentimes these efforts fail. And when they fail, those people who tried to have the hostile takeover of the Orthodox shul, they leave and they move. They found a conservative shul in another neighborhood. What might they try in terms of reviving the Secondary of Settlement Orthodox Synagogue. Well, they might make the rabbi a rabbi emeritus. You know, let's hire a new rabbi, speaks English from the pulpit. The older one would be emeritus. Okay, he has arthritis. We'll try the late Friday evening service. We'll try a kiddush, a social hour, a uniform prayer book. Because in the old Orthodox synagogues, there was no uniform prayer book. Today, we're accustomed. This place has art scroll. This place has Koran. Everybody's on the same page. No, but that wasn't the case in the old days. Everybody had their own sitter. But that's not good. You can't follow along if everybody has their own sitter. All right, so make a uniform prayer book and announce the pages. Maybe even use a microphone. And that's already a turning point. That's already a halachic divergence. And maybe the rabbi will cry foul. Or maybe some of the traditionalists will cry foul. So there were some non-Orthodox synagogues. There were some in areas of Second Settlement. But they were not relevant on the social scene. They were really of no consequence. The Orthodox shuls dominated. But while public observance in the shul was above board, you know, everybody was publicly observant of the halakha, in private, many people had drifted far, far away. So, for example, in 1920s, 30s, and 40s, areas of Second Settlement, how many people were using the mikveh? How many women of fertile age were using the mikveh? Very few. Even though it's Orthodox synagogues, you know, supposedly religious Jews, they were not all that traditional in their private lives, even though the synagogue was. So now let's turn to when the conservative synagogue actually is established. And I want to read to you a paragraph that Marshall Sklar writes in the end of the second chapter. The Second Settlement District is an area of transition. Many Jews who might form a public for the conservative movement do not continue to reside in the community for very long. Conservative synagogues come into existence by one of two methods. The first, the founding of an avowedly conservative congregation. The second, the modification of an Orthodox institution, meaning a gradual metamorphosis into a conservative synagogue. But given such prominent Orthodox institutions, development by the latter method is not feasible. The former alternative apparently demands more enthusiasm than is found in the community, for even the initiative for the founding of the present small group had to come from the outside. Meaning, why can't you so readily establish a conservative shul in the older neighborhood? Because it can only happen one of two ways, either a brand new shul or you change the old one. Well, the old guard is not ready to give up the reins of the old one, and to build a new one requires a lot of effort and commitment to the neighborhood. But the people who want to establish it are ready to move, so therefore it doesn't happen. When they move, then it will happen. Okay. Residence in an area where Jews are the majority does not encourage the concentration of ethnic survivalism under the sanction of religion. So basically, that's a mouthful. Conservative Judaism is ethnic survivalism under the sanction of religion. But that's important only when Jews are 10% of the population, 20% of the population, maybe 25% of the population in outer suburbia or the outer boroughs of New York City. But in the ethnic enclave, where Jews are 70% of the population or 80% of the population, there's no need to establish a new branch of Judaism that's really devoted to ethnic survivalism because the ethnicity is already surviving. It's not really under threat. Okay. In areas of third settlement, newly arrived Eastern European Jews want a shul that is on par with their level of acquired social prestige. So you don't want to go to a low-class shul. If you've made it, you've bought a house with a front yard and a backyard and a driveway and a car, and you're living, you know, the good life away from the old ethnic enclave. So you don't want your shul to be a shtetl shul. You want it to be a socially impressive house of worship. But you won't go to the Reform shul because it's too strange. You know, you go to a Reform shul, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. I want to hear kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. I don't want to hear holy, holy, holy. So it turned people off. Yes, for the old line German Jews, the holy, holy, holy of the Reform was fine, but not for the vast bulk of the Eastern European Jews. Even the ones who weren't all that traditional in their personal lives, when they go to shul, they want something that looks familiar. It sounds Jewish. Doesn't sound goyish. Okay. So they learn from the Reform synagogue about how to establish a new place. And so the conservative institution gets off the ground as a modernized house of worship that won't go as far in its religious departures from religious tradition, but will nonetheless appeal to Americanized people in these third areas of settlement. Okay. Jewish education in the third area is a lot less intense than it was in the second area. So, for example, I'll give you in my family. So my grandmother went to the Nulatz Talmud Torah 5 days a week, and he had to go to shul on Shabbos. There was like 15 hours of instruction a week in serious Judaism. It's a heavy load. By the time you go to Queens, to the conservative shuls of Queens, so it's 2 days a week or 3 days a week. It's dropped down a little bit. And that was in Queens, where things were good. If you go out to, you know, the far, far reaches in Long Island or Middle America, it was maybe 1 day a week, Sunday. So there's a diminution from one generation to the next of the intensity of the Hebrew school experience. Another change is, in areas of second settlement, people felt guilty if they violated religious norms because they knew what their parents had done and what they were departing from. And they felt a little residual guilt of what I didn't do right. In the third area of settlement, there's almost no residual feelings of guilt. Whatever you do, you do. Whatever you don't do, you don't really care anymore. What about Orthodox synagogues in the third area? So Sklar points out that there were Orthodox synagogues in third areas of settlement, but they were inconspicuous, they were small, they were out of the way, they were in the neighborhood, but not of the neighborhood. So I'll give you an example for my family. They moved to Queens, early 1950s. Everybody goes to Oakland Jewish Center. Oakland Jewish Center was the big powerhouse shul in Northeast Queens, conservative movement. There was an Orthodox shul not too far away from where my parents lived, Young Israel of Windsor Park. But Young Israel of Windsor Park was a tiny little nothing shul. Okay, and that's exactly what Marshall Sklar is saying, that there were Orthodox shuls in mid-20th century third areas, but they were tiny and they did not play a relevant role. Okay, we go to Great Neck, where I grew up, so that there it's a little bit different, but the powerhouse shul in 1950 was Rabbi Waxman's Temple Israel. The Great Neck Synagogue comes into being 1951, and it gets off the ground, and when Rabbi Wolf comes in 1956, it becomes a more significant part of the communal life, but still the powerhouse shul, the dominant force communally, was Temple Israel. Okay. Some Eastern European Jews in the third area of settlement did join Reform shuls. They did. But it was sometimes suspicious. Why are you joining a Reform shul? Don't you belong in a conservative shul? So I'll read to you a little story. The faces I saw there were those of Russian Jews whom I had known not so long before as dwellers of the West Side ghetto. These Jews could only recently have become members of the temple. It could not have been by the process of evolution that these people had advanced mentally to the stage where they sought a more rational aesthetic form of worship. The transformation had come too soon to be convincing, and the only logical explanation was that they were socially ambitious, meaning if you were socially ambitious, you might join a Reform shul just because the rich people went there and you wanted to hang out with the rich people. There were plenty of neighborhoods where this was true, that there was a real divide along the lines of the thickness of one's wallet between the Orthodox, the conservative, and the Reform. And if you jumped into the Reform camp before it made sense to, meaning you were still keeping kosher 5 minutes ago, why are you going to the Reform shul? It was social ambition. You're going up the social ladder very quickly. Conservative Judaism at this time had to navigate a course of feelings of alienation on the one hand from tradition and nostalgia on the other. And the key was the English-speaking rabbi who would allow people to have some comfort zone where they were not hit over the head with too much religion from which they had already been alienated, but also that they would get something that they would have the flavor of the nostalgia, they wouldn't feel they were missing out. But how much religion can you handle? How many services per week do people go to? How many times a week do you go to shul? Who knows? How many times a week? No, somebody tell me something. How many times a week do they go to shul?
Kiddush only.
One.
One, good. Okay, it's America. America is a Protestant.
You bet.
So the Gentiles will tell us it's a Protestant country, and the Protestants go to church once a week. So therefore, the good American Jew who's following in the footsteps of American religion goes to shul once a week, once a week. Okay. Well, in this shul where you're going once a week, there, who's going to show up? That's the real question. And what are you going to do when you get there? So the synagogues in the 50s came to the realization that they have to be child-centered, youth-centered. That if second-generation Jews, when they grew up in the old neighborhoods, did not have a youth department, they were led to run around like Vildachayas and play ball in the streets. The synagogue services were really for the adults, and the kids didn't do anything, and therefore they lost interest. But we can't have that happen again. The synagogue must cater to the children. And it must also cater to the interests of the adults. But the interests of the adults are going to be varied well beyond just attending shul services, which only once a week. So you have to have social activities and keep people within the synagogue building as much as possible. It's a big building with a lot of rooms and a lot of different things you could do in that building. So make a diversified program so that people have a reason to show up almost every day, even if it's not for a purely religious activity. Why did the Reform movement not do this? So the Reform movement, the Orthodox didn't do this because they didn't get the memo, and they were behind the times. But why didn't the Reform movement also try this idea of the synagogue center or the institutional synagogue with many different activities under one roof? The answer is twofold. One, the Reform were not obsessing over ethnic survival. They were not. If you obsess over ethnic survival, you want the local Jews, religious or irreligious, to show up to your building and do Jewish things with Jewish people every day. If you don't really care about that, there's no Vador Vador, there's no Nitzchiyut, then it doesn't matter. But there's another factor. And that, for those of you who are listening who are from Manhattan, or from my friends from Park East Synagogue, they'll know there's what's called the Bridge and Tunnel crowd, or the 718 crowd. What's the 718 crowd? It's the people who come to Manhattan to hang out in the fancy shuls, but they come from the outer boroughs. And they don't just come for the Kiddush, they come for services too, but for elevating their social prestige, the 718 crowd. The Reform movement, which was very haughty at that time, extremely haughty, full of themselves, about their social standing, did not want to have that 718 crowd entering their building. It's a disgusting thing to say, but it was true. That's the way things were. Okay, but as we'll see, the conservative synagogues also had an element of that, for which the rabbi tried to manipulate and change. Okay, so the conservative shul was a triple threat. It was a Beit Tefillah, house of prayer. It was a Beit Midrash, a house of study, and it was a Beit Knesset, a house of assembly, a Beit Am, all under one roof. You need a rabbi to tie this all together, a properly trained and educated rabbi who was the overseer over all these things.
But he can't do it alone.
What was that? Okay, but he can't do it alone. You need to have a staff, an office staff, because these synagogues are getting big. There's now a full operations, executive directors and the like, who are running the show. Okay, well, the conservative worship service is a middle-class service. The Orthodox service is a lower-class, underclass service. And the three big issues for the conservative movement at that time were the status of women, decorum in the davening, and eliminating commercialism. So the Orthodox, in the first half of the 20th century, basically blew their opportunity to engage the spiritual reserve, which is the 50% of the population that are women. Women are 50% of the population, but much more than that when it comes to attending services. In 20th century America, the men really lose interest in religion, not just Judaism, but Christianity as well, the church too. Who goes to religious services? The women are more spiritual, all right? So if you don't cater to them, if you throw them in the balcony in the Ezra's Nashim and there's nothing for them to do, then you're gonna lose out. In the conservative movement, the women are given opportunities. What kind of opportunities? Well, mixed seating is the big one, but also beyond mixed seating, women can get involved in the Friday night service in some measure of participation, which is not necessarily the case Saturday morning where the Torah scrolls are involved. That the physical Torah scroll is sort of off limits to women. It's still a man's domain in the conservative movement in mid-century. That will change. But those aspects of the service which can be manipulated and are away from the Torah scroll, like Friday night, the women have a much greater opportunity. But there was an inconsistency in the way this rule was applied. Okay, some synagogues allowed women to get aliyahs already in 1955. And some places allowed them to hold the Torah, open the yarek, do things. Some places allowed it only for bat mitzvah. Well, if you allow it for bat mitzvah, why don't you allow it after bat mitzvah? Why is a life cycle occasion somehow different than the rest of your life? And there was no good answer for that. But as Marshall Sklar noted in 1954, the women were not clamoring for greater participation. But he acknowledged that at a later time, they might do so. And in fact, in 1972, women famously protested the rabbinical assembly convention in the Concord Hotel in Kayamisha Lake, New York, and insisted upon, you know, full egalitarianism, which would follow within a decade. So, you know, the book is written in the 50s, but with an eye towards what might happen later on. Okay. The old Orthodox synagogues had no decorum, but that won't fly in suburbia. In suburbia, it has to look dignified. You can't have infants crying and three-year-olds running in and out. You can't have people schmoozing about the stock market or the ball game. You have to have people behaving themselves like a mensch, sitting in their pew with the book open, reading and listening to the professional clergy. So whereas in the Orthodox synagogue of the old neighborhood, the rabbi does not conduct the service. The rabbi just sits in his chair and davens like a yachid, like an individual, like everybody else. And the Baal Tefillah davens at the Yomid and conducts the service. In the conservative synagogue, the rabbi conducts the service. The rabbi he's not the Baal Tefillah. He's not the Baal Koreh. He's the conductor of the service. I didn't understand this until I became a congregational rabbi in Manhattan, where there, in the big Manhattan shuls, the rabbi really does conduct the service in the sense of dictating who goes where and when, and trying to make sure there's no downtime or dead time or tirchet tzibur. Okay. What about commercialism? So the goal was to get rid of commercialism, the sale of honors, the schnuttering. I hate that word, schnuttering. Such an ugly word. The Kol Nidre appeal. But we need the Kol Nidre appeal. How can we do without the Kol Nidre appeal? The shul needs to pay the Con Ed bill. So what do you do? The answer is, well, there are a few answers. One, raise the dues. In mid-century America, you can charge people dues and they'll pay it, and that will cover the bulk of your budget, unlike in the old neighborhood where there was hardly any due payments. And major donations and sale of honors is how they recovered the cash. The other thing you can do is you can solicit money in a more dignified fashion, the silent appeal. Guy comes up for an aliyah, the gabbai gives him a mishaberach, hand him an envelope. Here's your envelope, sir. You don't say how much you're giving. You don't say the ershtemol, the tzveitemol, the dritemol, zacha, selling aliyahs. No, that's ugly. That's commercialism. You hand the guy an envelope, and tomorrow at his own leisure, he'll write you a check and send it in the mail. Okay? So you clean things up. But people are not coming to shul. They're coming for the high holidays, but otherwise the crowd is very small. On an average Shabbos, only the old timers and the lower class people are coming. You try a telephone squad, call people, we need you, please come to services. Doesn't work. Another tactic that conservative rabbis invented was the use them or lose them tactic. Use them or lose them. What's use them or lose them? You're going to get Rishon, and you're going to get Shani, and you're going to open the Ark for this one. You're going to open the Ark by name is Miros. In other words, you give out honor cards for a regular Shabbos, not for high holidays, not for, you know, Kol Nidre and Unisana Tokif. No, a regular Shabbos. But you tell people ahead of time, we need you to do this, that, and the other thing. And you divide it up a thousand ways from Sunday, all of a sudden more people are coming to shul. Well, it's a nice gimmick, but did it work? Hardly. Another thing that they try are guest rabbis and guest speakers. Again, that's a gimmick that hardly ever works. Who goes to the daily minion in these shuls? So Norman is asking, what about charging for high holiday tickets? And the answer is that that's a big problem, because if you charge for tickets but allow the sale to non-members, then what incentive is there to become a member? And the same thing with Hebrew school education. If you allow non-members to enroll their kid in Hebrew school, then there's no incentive to become a member. So high holiday tickets and Hebrew school enrollment are the two grabs that the shul has over the constituency. You have to use that to your best advantage, which means restricting it potentially to only to the dues payers. Okay. Now, who goes to the daily minyan? So let me ask, somebody answer my question. Who went to the daily minyan, mid-20th century America, in the conservative shul?
Say Kaddish.
To say Kaddish. Good. Who else? Who else?
Your bar mitzvah practice.
What was that? Bar mitzvah?
The older people.
The older people. Good. Now
celebrate bar mitzvah on Thursday morning, for example.
So that's also true. That's also true.
A baby birth.
All right. Well, naming a baby, a bris, that sort of thing. But the answer is, who goes on a regular basis?
Europeans.
Retirees, people who don't have to go to work. But these retirees who are going are not necessarily people who for their whole lives were minyan goers. No, they might have even been chalei Shabbos and chazer fressers for most of their lives. But when they retire, all of a sudden they get a little more frum than they were before. Why? It's something to do, you know, and they have Danish at the end. All right, so, or a piece of herring. So the conservative shuls, they had minyan usually. They almost always had minyan. But who was going? Older people, and not necessarily those who went their whole lives. What about the rabbi? Does the rabbi go to shul every day? Yes or no?
No.
Correct. The rabbi doesn't always go. So there were conservative rabbis who were very traditional Jews, who could have been Orthodox rabbis. You know, they were frum at heart and indeed. But most of the conservative rabbis of that era were not especially frum. Let's face it, they were not in their private behavior. And going to minyan would have lowered their social prestige. Because who goes to minyan? People with limited kesef on social security, the oldsters, who he doesn't want to necessarily associate with. Rather, he wants to be known as, you know, for everybody, including for the young people. So a lot of the rabbis did not go to shul every day. So who ran the minyan? The gabbai, the shamash, the servants. Now, what about going to shul on shlosh regalim? Who goes to shul shlosh regalim? The answer is almost nobody, except for Yisker. So Yisker is popular, but not Yom Tov Rishon. Now, the Friday night service became, in many places, the main weekly service. Although, interestingly, not in New York City. If you know, if you come from somewhere outside of the New York area and you had a bit of a conservative background, you might remember the Friday night davening being the big deal. In New York, especially in Brooklyn and Queens and in Long Island, that actually wasn't true. The Saturday morning service was the main service, although for bat mitzvahs, the Friday night one was
right
useful. Okay. Why did the Friday night davening become so popular? The answer is because, number one, it's shorter than the Saturday morning service. People can't tolerate 3 hours. Nobody wants to sit for 3 hours. Friday night is an hour and a half at most. Secondly, you have more wiggle room halachically. Because Kabbalah Shabbos is not halachic service. It's just really a custom. So you can play around with it a little bit more and not run afoul of the technicalities.
The men want to play golf.
Oh, bingo. All right. Men want to play golf. The women want to go shopping. Whatever it is, you want your Saturday to yourself. And Saturday morning. So if you do your Jewish thing Friday night, you're yotze zayin to Judaism, and Saturday is all free and clear. You can do whatever you want.
Children could participate Friday more readily, and they became part of a budding choir movement. I want you to know.
So Friday night has greater opportunity for children because there's less riding on it halachically. Saturday morning is, you know, Torah reading. You need to be a bar mitzvah boy to have an aliyah. So under 13, Friday night, there's better, you know, more opportunity. Also, the rabbi has an opportunity to speak on any topic that he wants. He doesn't feel constrained to talk about Parshas HaShavua. So also, because it's a shorter service, he can allot more time to his sermonizing, to his oratory, as opposed to Saturday morning where, you know, we got to get out eventually. And if the guy goes on too long, people are getting antsy in the seats. Also, Friday night davening allows the worshiper to be involved with limited facility in Hebrew. You don't have to know that much Hebrew to sit back and watch the clergy, you know, as a spectator, watching the clergy do their thing and occasionally chime in for a melody that is familiar. Saturday morning requires a much greater facility with Hebrew and knowledge of the prayer book. Okay. What kind of topics did the rabbis talk about in these sermons? So a survey was done, and it seems people wanted to hear about general Jewish problems. They didn't want to hear old-fashioned homiletics, or biblical interpretations. They wanted general Jewish problems. The fourth thing on the list was ethical issues. Ethics was not a big to-do. No, ethics you leave for somewhere else. General Jewish problems of the community at large. Okay. The popularity of the Friday night service had to do a lot with the social hour. The social hour was the key to success. Not just tea and cookies, but even have a nice repast, a real kiddush. Okay? And when is this happening? It's happening after dinner, meaning dinner is 6 o'clock in the evening or 5 o'clock in the evening. The service could be 6:30, 7 o'clock. It ends at 8. You've already eaten dinner, but now you can have a dessert or you can have something else. So this is a convenient hour, and you enjoy the schmoozing and the fressing that comes with it. Another strategy that Jules employed was gimmick Shabbos, where you have UJA Shabbos, Israel Bonds Shabbos, Federation Shabbos. The traditionalists didn't like it because they thought it compromised the spirituality of the service. Too much solicitation, too much focus on the secular aspects of the communal life. But the rabbis tended to like it because it put people in pews. You know, if you were involved in a certain philanthropy in the community, and they were having a special Shabbos in the local synagogue, you felt compelled to go. Okay. The form of worship and the content of worship. Conservative Judaism in the mid-century offered a fairly radical change in the form of worship, but very minimal change in the content of worship, meaning the words recited are pretty much the same as they were in the Orthodox synagogue. It's just the setup of the synagogue, where the cantor faces, where the rabbi faces, the women and women together. The layout is different, and maybe the strategic placement of certain prayers is different, but the words on the page are the same. Now, some would claim that the conservative shul was really an Orthodox shul Sunday through Friday, and was not conservative on Shabbos. In the early days, the spokesman for the movement liked to emphasize, we have not tampered with the liturgy, that it's really a traditional liturgy. Now, why did they pride themselves on that? Why did they trumpet that point? Because they were still concerned about not alienating the Orthodox rabbis, the Orthodox lay people. There was a goal to not offend the traditional element in the community. So you say, all right, yes, we're different, but what the stuff we say, tachlis, is the same. Okay, so my great-grandfather, Izzy, all right, Yisroel, after whom I'm named, when he would go, when he came to Queens from Brooklyn, so he would, Rabbi Isaacson in Oakland Jewish Center would ask him to daven Sukkot HaZimra from the Omud. And he would happily do it. Why? Because it was the same davening, the Birnbaum sitter, whether you're in an Orthodox shul or conservative shul, it's the same sitter. Okay, so Norman is asking, when did the text change? We'll get to that shortly. Okay, so conservative Judaism was founded after the emancipation. Why does that matter? Because Reform Judaism, which is founded simultaneous with or just before the emancipation, feels the need to change and to radically change the liturgy in order to justify Jewish rights, meaning getting rid of the return to Zion, all the korbanos, goodbye, expurgation, because we need to excise all that stuff that no longer fits our role as modern free citizens in society. Well, conservative movement is 100 years later. They don't have to worry about that. So there's no external pressure to change the text. If there's no external pressure, and internally the Jews don't even know what they're saying because they don't know Hebrew, then why change it? Nobody's forcing you to change it. Just say it. Okay. The layperson was largely ignorant of the rabbi's ideas about religion beyond the form of religion, the external forms. And the rabbis were often annoyed with themselves and frustrated in their profession because they had great thoughts, or so they thought they had great thoughts about religion, about Judaism, but they can't talk about it because the people aren't interested in listening. And even if they did listen, they wouldn't understand. So the liturgy was one of those areas where they might have wanted to offer some substantive substantive emendations, but it's going to go over the heads of everybody, so why bother? Okay. Intellectuals were missing from the movement. There were almost no intellectuals in the conservative movement. I don't mean among the rabbis. I mean among the laity. The intellectuals tended to be irreligious completely, either far leftists, old line communists, whatever they might be. But the conservative synagogue rarely ever had an intellectual layperson who was concerned about ideological issues in Judaism.
A rabbi had it.
Yeah. Good question.
I would say our rabbi had that years ago.
Okay, which rabbi?
I'm not naming names.
Okay. So, now the question is, why keep the mitzvot? And that's an ideological question or a theological question that if there were intellectuals involved, they would ask this and insist upon answers and try to offer answers that were coherent.
That's why Rabbi Joshua Heschel stands out so conspicuously. During the 50s and 60s, there was no discussion of civil rights in any of the conservative synagogues.
It was definitely not on the radar until at least the mid-60s. Then, in some places, yes, although a rabbi could get himself into trouble if he focused on that too much.
Heschel, Rabbi Prince in New Jersey also,
Heschel was on that already from the early 50s, even from the late 40s. That was a priority of his. Okay, so why keep the mitzvot? The answer is, in the traditional sense, because they're heavenly commandments. But that wasn't going to go over well among an acculturated audience. And so the answer was social utility. You keep the mitzvot because of social utility. And there's no divine sanction for non-observance. What about the prayers? Don't delete anything. Add supplemental English prayers. And translate things non-literally if anybody really has a problem. In other words, if they're bothering to read the English and a literal translation will offend someone, okay, offer a non-literal translation. But this way you could keep the original Hebrew without doing any injustice to the text. However, Mordechai Kaplan didn't like this at all. He wanted intellectuals, and he didn't like non-literal translation to cover over what essentially are outdated doctrines. Kaplan said, say what you mean and mean what you say. Say what you mean and mean what you say. None of this falsifying the translation to make everybody happy. Now, conservative Judaism was very late in officially sanctioning, sponsoring publications of the Siddur, of the Machzor, of the Chumash. Okay, if you went to a conservative shul in 1948, 49, 50, 51, you might have used the Silverman prayer book, the 1946 Silverman. But most people didn't. Most people used the old Adler Machzor or the Birnbaum Siddur, and then maybe the Birnbaum Machzor. It was not until the 60s and beyond that conservative publication became the standard issue in conservative shuls. And the reason for this delay was that when you publish a Siddur or a Chumash, it forces you to confront doctrinal issues. And if you don't want to because they're uncomfortable and you don't have good answers that satisfy your lay people, you're better off not engaging in the enterprise. Just use an old book and that's fine. Okay. Now, what were the different categories of people and different groups, social groups, than the mid-century synagogue? So the strongest of all the groups was the sisterhood. The sisterhood, without a doubt, was the strongest entity. And it was different from the ladies' auxiliary of the 1920s and 30s. The ladies' auxiliary of the Borough Park Shul in the 20s and 30s, they raised money for the synagogue by doing this or that sale, right? But they had no real clout in the affairs of the congregation. They just were a ladies' auxiliary on the side. the 1950s conservative sisterhood, they could force the rabbi to do something if they really wanted it. They had power because they went to shul more than the men did. They raised money sometimes more than the men did. And they really had an interest in the whole thing. The men's club was typically weaker than the sisterhood. The men's club encouraged athletic activities and social outings for the men and the for the fathers and the young boys. Then there was the young marriage group. The young marriage group was also known as the couples club. And these were people who were too young to be in the sisterhood. Sisterhood was for the women who were like upper, you know, late 30s, 40s, and 50s. If you were late 20s and early 30s, there was the young marriage, the couples club. Then there was also the parents association. The parents association were for the people who were not really involved in shul life, but the kid went to the cheder. And because the kid went to the cheder, they had to be involved somehow, and they cared about their kid's education to an extent, and so they were involved in PTA. Then there was the golden group, some places had for the senior citizens. And then there was the most controversial of them all, the young adults, the singles crowd. The rabbis had a problem with the single people. Why? Because the single people were oftentimes socially on a lower madrega, a lower level than the rest of the congregation. The rest of the congregation were families, nuclear families, husband and wife and children that owned homes. And, you know, there was a breadwinner and they had achieved a certain level of prestige. Whereas the young person might still be in school, in professional school, not yet earning a livelihood, still living in the mother's basement, who knows what. But they're not wealthy enough to bring any kavod to the house of worship. Also, they were not especially Jewishly interested in davening or learning or like that. And they did not pay dues. They were effectively freeloaders who came for the singles events. So what do you do with these people? There's a real question. How do you deal with the freeloader? On the one hand, from an institutional point of view, they bring nothing to the table. On the other hand, if you're interested in ethnic survival, then you want this person not to marry a Gentile. And you want them to marry a Jew. And the best way to facilitate that is to include them in synagogue life and let them mingle and swingle, and hopefully something good will happen. And in the long run, if this person is in professional school, all right, 5 years from now, they'll earn a big parnasa. And then they'll join the shul and pay dues and make big donations. So in the short run, the institution suffers from catering to them. In the long run, Judaism benefits from catering to them, and maybe even the institution benefits from catering to them. So it was a big question. All right. There was a worry that Hebrew school and high holiday seats would not produce synagogue loyalty. We are concerned for the viability of the house of worship. You got to pay the bills. Our people have salaries to earn, and you got to pay the Con Ed bill. You need money. Well, if you need money, you need people to remain members for the long haul. If they're here only because their kid goes to Hebrew school, when the kid finishes Hebrew school, it's goodbye membership dues. If they're only coming for the high holidays, and even that sort of only reluctantly, are they really going to pay dues? So you have to do something for them to bring them into the building more often. Otherwise, you'll lose them. They won't feel invested in this institution enough to put down a lot of money on it. And that was a big challenge that many rabbis never found an adequate solution for. Okay. The Hebrew schools did not teach personal observance for the children. If they did, it wouldn't have gone over well. If the parents are not especially pious and really are observing nothing at home, and the kid learns about putting on tefillin and saying brachas over a cup of water, of shahakol, you know, household rituals and personal observance, davening thrice daily, it's inconsistent with what they're trying to get across. Instead, the focus was on synagogue participation. Adequate enough, you could get through their life cycle occasions and become a functioning member of the synagogue as an adult. One of the problems that the rabbis had was that by their temperament, they couldn't run a Hebrew school. Now, they were trained to be a scholar, an adjudicator of Jewish law, to Paskin Shilas maybe, but not to run a cheder for Vildachaya children. And it was a real problem. And so the conservative movement had to develop a cadre of teachers and administrators of schools that could get this job done. And really, there was a separating of the responsibilities because the rabbi was supposed to be this, you know, on this level, very, you know, lofty level to project honor and glory for the community. And that's not the running of a Talmud Torah. Okay. What about learning for the adults? So the rabbi was supposed to offer that, but hardly anybody was interested. There was almost no learning for the adults. What about for high school age kids? So over time, the conservative movement developed high school programming, but at mid-century, it was almost non-existent, almost non-existent. Later on, by the 60s, it would be more popular, though it never was especially popular. Okay, what about day schools? Are members of conservative shuls sending their children to all-day Jewish schools, yes or no? Yes or no?
No. Now, yes.
Yes.
They went now, to one. Yes.
But then the answer is back not... then, very, very few. Today, there's a considerable number. The Salman Schechter schools and in Westchester, the LaFell school. Okay, there are such people.
In YCQ, there was a lot of conservative people.
Good. So YCQ did have, okay, my aunt went to YCQ and they were members of Oakland Jewish Center. So yes, that did exist. So the question is, why? Why did people send their kids to day school if they were in a conservative environment where the vast bulk of the population was really not religious at all and were sending their kids to Hebrew school, which was
one of the elitist schools?
Grandpa. What?
Okay, so let me read to you several explanations. One, to avoid the irritation of going to Hebrew school, meaning Hebrew school is so annoying that I'll send my kid to day school just so they don't have to go to Hebrew school. And that might sound as a shock, but for those who really hated Hebrew school, I could understand why. Now, another reason is overcrowding in the public schools. If your neighborhood happened to be a place where they didn't build a sufficient number of public schools, you know, the town elders dropped the ball, and now it's crowded in the local PS whatever number, so all right, it's not a good education there. It's just too crowded. Send your kid to all-day school. Alternatively, you want the individual attention of a private school education. You know, for your tuition payment, your kid will get specialized attention. Alternatively, the mothers don't want to have to prepare lunch. I have it in the book right here. Mothers do not have to prepare lunches. Now, I don't know why that's true, because when I went to North Shore Hebrew Academy, there was no hot lunch in my day. You had to get a brown bag lunch. I don't know what this is talking about. But
YCQ had good lunches.
They did? All right.
Yes.
So...
And my wife says, so you see a flapper.
I'm sure they did. So,
Rabbi, you didn't mention to avoid going to school with minorities.
Ah, okay, good. So that was true in a limited number of places, but for the most part, the Jews had already moved to certain neighborhoods where the public school did not present that problem. If you were still in an area of settlement that was a half a rung down and it was changing fairly rapidly and you had not gotten out yet, then yes, that would hold true. Okay. So the rabbis had to be trained to function as conservative rabbis in this style of Judaism, but they really weren't trained for it. They went to the seminary where they learned Wissenschaft des Judentum, the scientific study of Judaism. And their teachers were quite traditional, old line European scholars who were themselves orthopraxes in their style of observance. But the one thing that the seminary did teach them, and by virtue of not being a yeshiva, but a seminary, was a compromise attitude on observance, meaning if you're not doctrinaire in the way you learn, if you're open to critical study, to critical methods of study, then you also have to be open, a little bit at least, to modification of religion in the here and now. And you're not going to bust the chops of people, lay people, who are sliding down the scale of observance.
Sliding down a hill.
Yeah. So the rabbis are not answering halachic questions. They're not using their Talmudic acumen, not at all. What are these rabbis becoming? They're becoming priests, pastors, preachers, the three P's, but not a posek, okay, not the fourth P. This bothered the rabbis, many of them, terribly, because they felt their training was wasted. Why did I learn Talmud with Louis Ginsberg and Saul Lieberman all those years just so that I could play games with the lay people in suburbia and never answer a question of any serious Judaic consequence? The lay people didn't understand that. The rabbis were suffering a crisis of identity in their profession, and the lay people just didn't get it. Okay. Now the rabbis were very deferential to their seminary professors. The schoolmen, the professors, denigrated the shul rabbis because they felt that the real good students at the seminary went into academia. Only the lesser students, or the ones who were going to waste their time, went into the congregational rabbinate. At one of the rabbinical assembly conventions, Rabbi Greenfield, who was one of the left-wingers, complained bitterly, "They laugh at us as ignoramuses and imply that we have been graduated as social workers and not as rabbis for humanity." That's a terrible thing to say, but he meant it wholeheartedly, that they're making fun of us, that they think we're social workers and we're not real rabbis. It was a problem. Okay. So then the other question is, who will the future rabbis of the conservative movement be? That's what Sclair is asking in the 1950s. Because why did these rabbis attain a degree of success? Because they were just like their members. The members were second-generation American Jews who had risen up the ranks, up the social ladder, and gone to suburbia, third area of settlement. These rabbis were just like that. They grew up in Orthodox synagogues in the inner boroughs, went to the seminary, okay, and went to the outer boroughs. So the rabbi and the layperson had the same basic trajectory. So it made sense. But once that was no longer true, once you've tapped out of the supply of Orthodox ex-yeshiva bachers to become conservative rabbis, who's going to become a rabbi? So because they were worried about this, by the 1960s, they began the LTC, leadership training stuff, with Kaplan and the others at the camps in Ramah, at Sedgwin, all right? Because they wanted to cultivate another generation of would-be leaders, and maybe some of them will become rabbis. Very few actually did, though. It was a decline in the total number because it just wasn't all that tempting. I mean, in mid-century suburbia, who wants their kid to become a rabbi? Nobody, or almost nobody. Okay. We have just a few minutes left. So the ideology of the movement. The ideology of the movement was never clearly articulated. And that was on purpose. Many people identified it as a halfway house between Reform and Orthodox. And although there were those who were offended by that, saying that's not true, there's more substance to it than just being a halfway house. But from a sociological perspective, it really was a halfway house. People responded to a survey, to a professional survey that was done in the early 50s, about why they identified as conservative Jews. And their answers almost always had to do with religious practice, meaning what I do is what I think fits in with conservative Judaism. Meaning my level of observance and non-observance can be, you can find that spot on the spectrum, and that spot is called conservative Judaism. Almost nobody gave an answer that pertained to religious belief, doctrine. Why not? Well, the answer is because nobody really spoke about doctrine, and the average layperson wasn't really familiar with the doctrines. So that's not how they would answer when a pollster says, "Why are you a conservative Jew?" JTS was very much opposed to the movement led by the United Synagogue issuing a statement of principles. The seminary wanted to be a place of rigorous rabbinic studies that was transdenominational, or essentially non-denominational, but skewed towards tradition. If the movement were to issue a platform, like the Reform at the Pittsburgh platform, the Columbus platform, the San Francisco platform, the Reform do it all the time. But the conservative, they were afraid if we issue a platform, then the seminary suffers because those who can't make peace with the platform will divorce themselves from the seminary. And we can't have that happen. In 1946, the United Synagogue tried this, to try to articulate some ideology, and it failed. Simon Greenberg was the vice chancellor of the seminary, ended up taking control of it, and the effort came to naught. It was not until the 1980s when Bob Gordas, Rabbi Robert Gordas, who was a retired professor of Bible and a retired rabbi from Rockaway Park,
big macher of the conservative movement, Gordas, and the father of Daniel, the grandfather of Daniel Gordas. He led the commission in the 1980s, which produced Emet Ve'emunah. And that was sort of a hodgepodge of ideological principles designed to make sure that nobody left the movement, to keep the center, the left, and the right all happy. Okay. But there's a reason why they can't articulate principles. It's because there's no agreement. There really is a divided rabbinate. Forget the laity, but the rabbinate was divided between right-wingers, who basically were Orthodox, centrists, who were movement people, and left-wingers, who were reconstructionist and essentially didn't believe in God. So because the theological beliefs and the halachic practices of the rabbis were so diverse, putting forth one statement simply wasn't going to work. Not everybody was going to agree with it, so don't bother trying. Okay, we ran out of time. So the last point I want to make is that conservative Judaism, in the eyes of Marshall Sklar, saved a generation of American Jews for Judaism. It was good while it lasted. It fulfilled its historic mission. But its historic mission necessarily had an expiration date on it. Why? Because those who clung to tradition and who found excitement and enthusiastic about religious observance tended to gravitate towards orthodoxy. And those who were indifferent and were involved institutionally, because everyone was involved institutionally in mid-century, eventually went the way of assimilation. And by the way, not even towards reform, but just to total indifference and non-affiliation completely. So that's why, whereas it was believed by many that the conservative movement would be the regnant form of Judaism in America for the foreseeable future, it was, but only for a few decades, and still hangs on because, you know, institutions are reluctant to close up shop. But the individual synagogues really are on their own. The movement, meaning the United Synagogue, is very weak, very, very weak in the last two decades. So you have individual conservative synagogues that are very strong and will continue to be strong because in that neighborhood, there's a critical mass and they have a good rabbi and they have well-funded endowment and they can do their thing and kol hakavod to them. But as a movement, it fizzled out to the point where they are today. So one last point I want to mention before we get to take a couple of questions. So the reluctance on the part of the rabbis to formally countenance changes in the law, which is what I was studying in graduate school, we discussed a couple of years ago. Sklar talks about that too. He says that changing the halacha is something that only makes sense if people need the change in order to accommodate the behavior of the lay people. But if the lay people are going to act however they're going to act, irrespective of what the rabbis say, then making formal changes is almost an embarrassment. Doesn't really serve much of a purpose. Unless the rabbis themselves need the change in the halacha to justify their own personal behavior, which sometimes was true. So the edifice of the conservative halacha was never to be lived by thousands and thousands of people. It was essentially an intellectual exercise that people engaged in because it made them feel good, that rabbis like to discuss religious issues. They can't discuss religious issues with congregants in any great depth, so they discuss it among themselves at their conventions and at their committee meetings. And it gives them hana, satisfaction. Okay, so for all the agmas nefesh, the travail of being a congregational rabbi, at least in the privacy of the of your cloistered group of rabbis, you can engage in a kind of discourse that makes you happy. That's what Sklar says. I think he's mostly right. I have my own take, which is a little bit different. But for those who are interested in halachic changes, that's where it stands. Okay, I'll take questions now.
How does the trajectory of the conservative movement affect the JTS?
So the answer to that is that JTS was able for many decades to push away the liberalism of the lay people's movement, and to remain dominated by faculty that was orthoprax and in many cases orthodox. But by the 1970s, that began to change, where you had faculty members who grew up in the conservative movement wanted to see the institution change. Of course, the ordination of women was the big one, but that's not the only big one. Other considerations are the teaching of critical study of the Bible. For many years, JTS didn't have a Bible professor or chair of the department because they were reluctant to allow someone to teach things that are regarded as apikorsis, heresy. So the seminary evolved later than the movement, a good 2-3 decades later.
Question?
Yeah.
Hi. I remember growing up on Kew Garden Hills in the 50s, and I remember before the Young Israel came in, which changed a lot. I was sent to a Sunday school that was full in Main Street Jewish Center.
Yeah.
By Kirschbaum, who himself was Orthodox.
Yeah.
They
named the street after him.
What?
They named the street after him. You'll see the sign.
Right. But it was full. It was a wonderful Sunday school, you know. And then the Young Israel came in, and they had a full program for kids, you know, even on Shabbos. And it was just a different kind of a flavor when Rabbi Schoenfeld came in. And I think Rabbi Schoenfeld, many recipes, said he viewed with sorrow the closing of the Talmud Torahs because he felt they were very important.
So I'm glad you mentioned the Talmud Torahs, and with this we'll have to close, but I want to make a point about that. The Talmud Torahs were usually not under the auspices of any particular synagogue. In the old neighborhood, they were independent entities, and they were very strong. By mid-century and in the third areas of settlement, where conservative synagogues became powerful, it was necessary to have Jewish education subsumed under the overall auspices of the synagogue, and independent Talmud Torahs ceased to exist. But the question would be, when the synagogues took it over, did they maintain the rigor of the old Talmud Torah, or did they water down their offering to cater to the wishes of those who wanted a much less intense experience? And the answer is, some places did this, some places did that, and some places did both. They had dual track. They would 3-day a week for those who wanted serious Talmud Torah, and Sunday alone for those who really didn't want serious Talmud Torah. But you couldn't sustain that in the long term to have dual tracks under synagogue auspices. So inevitably, one of them would close, and you would just have one style of Hebrew school.
But not everybody could afford to go to the day school in those.
Right. So there were plenty of people who would have wanted day school education, but it was pricey. A time before people have reached great wealth. And so the Talmud Torah was necessary for people who wanted to really to learn. And it was good for a while. Okay, folks. Next week, 8:30, we'll discuss post-1948 American Zionism. Okay, take care, everyone. Good night.
Thank you.